So I started with reading on the island, but as a segue in, reading from the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Buddha's discourse on the noble search, and didn't quite finish the sutta. It's the Buddha describing his own motivations and his own search for awakening, and we got up to his actual awakening. Yesterday was the essence of what I really wanted to convey, just that sense of the Buddha's process of motivating himself. But then there are some interesting aspects of the sutta that are worth summarizing or bringing to people's attention. Most people probably know the story of the Buddha. He has awakened and he has set the intention to teach, and then he says, who should I teach? Who will understand this Dhamma? And then he thinks of his former teachers, Alara Kalama, Uddhaka Ramaputta, and realizes that both of them have passed away. And then he thinks of the group of five ascetics who practiced with him, practiced together, and he says, the bhikkhus of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to them. Then I thought, where are the bhikkhus of the group of five now living? And with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw that they were living at Banaras in the Deer Park at Isipatana, which is kind of an indication of the degree of disaffection that they felt. I think it's hard to consider that, so he stopped his ascetic practices or he appeared to have stopped his ascetic practices, so he's sort of given up. But they're, you know, I think they're quite disappointed and went off. Because from, say, Bodh Gaya to the Deer Park at Isipatana, it's about 200 kilometers. And I think in the time of India in those days, I mean, it's a long way by any kind of stretch of the imagination. And you think of even in England, which is, we're here in a modern country. People don't go very far. I mean, it's different in America where your distances are quite, it's a 3-hour. It's like for a bike, Erie to the airport, it's a 3-hour drive. It's just this, and you just do it all the time. So Bodh Gaya to Isipatana, it'd be like from Amaravati to Cardiff. I looked on Google Maps. Amaravati to Cardiff or Amaravati to Leeds, about that kind of distance. And so it's just a thing. You think, wow, that's really a long way away. And so they really left. And the Buddha makes the effort to go and teach them, to track them down and to focus on them as the first people who he felt would be suitable to understand his teachings. So there's a lot of effort that's being put in to make this happen. And then, of course, this is a well-known story that Lopo Samedo, Ajahn Amaro, will bring up from time to time when the Buddha, on his way walking, and then a wandering ascetic saw him, was inspired, the Ajivaka Upaka, friend, your faculties are clear, the color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess? And then the Buddha's reply is like a declarative style of teaching. As if he's trying to teach him, it's sort of, I am one who has transcended all, knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all. By craving, ceasing, freed, having known this all for myself, to whom should I point as a teacher? And that goes on for quite some time. Sort of a set of about 4 stanzas. And the Upaka is a bit taken aback by this. The Buddha has just overwhelmed him. Even if it's true, it's like it's not useful. You don't need to say you're the greatest all the time. When this was said, the Ajivaka Upaka said, may it be so, friend. Shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. Sort of like, okay, good. I hope you go for it. So then the bhikkhus, the wandering ascetics, the group of five, were not initially receptive to the Buddha. Then the Buddha says, have you ever known me to speak like this before? In a sense, I've realized something. The deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. Practicing as you're instructed by realizing for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal, the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. And the Buddha is verifying his teaching and his insight, and then they agree to receive teachings. I was able to convince the bhikkhus of the group of five. Then I sometimes instructed two bhikkhus, while the other three went for alms, and six of us lived on what those three bhikkhus brought back from their alms round. Sometimes I instructed three bhikkhus, while the other two went for alms, and six of us lived on what the two bhikkhus brought back from their alms round. Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. So in the same way, following that theme, being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger, they attained the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme security from bondage. Knowledge and vision arose in them. Our deliverance is unshakable. This is our last birth. There is no renewal of being. It doesn't give a description of the Buddha's teaching, but that's where the Buddha gave the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, laying out the Four Noble Truths. Then Anyakandanya had the insight into stream entry, and then over subsequent days, the rest of the group also entered the stream. When they all entered the stream, then the Buddha gave the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which was the catalyst for all five of them realizing full awakening. The account for that is in the Vinaya, in the Mahavagga. That's a more full account rather than in this discourse. And then the Buddha kind of wraps it up with the sense of the, you know, what needs to be cultivated and developed, turning away from the sense realm and the five chords of sensual pleasure and seeking a stillness of heart through the four jhanas, the four formless attainments. And his taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. So the cultivation of wisdom and insight. And then that is what the sutta ends with. That's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. This particular sutta, I thought it was interesting because it's the Buddha describing his thought process of what led him to seek liberation and what he worked with. Any questions on this sutta? This was basically tying up odds and ends from that. The bulk of it was from yesterday. Yeah?
It is more a historical question. I mean, you mentioned very precise words and precise action of the Buddha, but how do we know that it's a genuine story or very genuine words because they were written hundreds of years after
his... Oh, you can just doubt it. It's okay. If that helps you, if that helps you be happy. I mean, you can't know. We accept it through tradition. I mean, one of the things that I find that gives me confidence with the Pali Canon is that there actually are multiple descriptions of the Buddha's awakening. And they come from different angles or different perspectives. So they're not trying to, how do you say, like whitewash it? Or even that sense of the Buddha being, you know, they're just recounting. And where the Buddha declares his awakening, and then the wandering ascetic, yeah, well, maybe so, and walked away and wasn't impressed by it at all. It's not trying to whitewash. It's just trying to give an account, more or less. But, you know, I mean, in a sense, it is 2,600 years. And, you know, there's going to be some things that are not absolutely thing, but the point of it is not so much, is every word true? Is there enough to free my heart from suffering? And that's the point. Okay. Back to the island. So these are the chapters that I wrote. There's like three chapters on this, practices and perspectives. A lot of it is just trying to give a picture of what are ways of training, practicing, what are ways of viewing the practice, viewing the teachings that are useful to realization of nibbana. So I begin with a heading, the gradual path. And because Dajahn Amaro's chapters are on kind of like descriptions of different facets and aspects of nibbana, and I turn the attention to the different practices and ways of viewing. We turn now to consider the practices that facilitate the penetration of nibbana. These practices include views, ways of regarding the world of experience. Our view may be unreliable as a means of seeing truth. A part of the path leading to nibbana includes the process of reflecting on descriptions of nibbana so as to gain clear understanding. The need for this sort of reflection derives from the role of perception in aiding or thwarting the attainment of liberation. What I'm sort of introducing is just the importance of how do we view things? How are we perceiving the world around us? How are we perceiving ourselves? How are we perceiving our experience? And then I begin with a quote. This is from the Anguttara 4, 179. Then the Venerable Ananda went to visit the Venerable Sariputta, and on coming to him, greeted him courteously. As he sat down at one side, the Venerable Ananda asked the Venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, what is the reason, what is the cause, why certain beings in this world are not fully set free in this very life?" "In this matter, friend Ananda, beings do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to decline." And the Pali is Hana Bhagya Sanya. "They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to stability. Titi Bhagya Sanya. They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to distinction. Visesa Bhagya Sanya. They do not understand as it really is. This perception is conducive to penetration. Nibbeda Bhagya Sanya. This, friend, is the reason, this is the cause why some beings in this world are not fully set free in this very life." And then similarly, the opposite is then laid out, why are they set free in this very life? And it's because they do understand perception conducive to decline, conducive to stability, conducive to distinction, conducive to penetration. So perception, it's such a dense sutta, but a really important one, I felt, to begin this chapter with. The perception is what conditions all of our thoughts, words, and deeds. Perception is an integral part of all of our thought processes. Being able to understand how to direct attention using perception and also acknowledging or recognizing what perceptions are we carrying into things, our experience, our interactions, the world around us. As the sutta above shows, we have the opportunity to be fully set free in this very life, but are unable to do this as a result of our not seeing clearly. If we were able to recognize that a particular way of perception would lead to a decline in skillful state or result in well-being, then we would happily relinquish it as in our best interests. The sense of decline is perceptions that lead us to certain biases in the mind, like there's what are called akati in Pali. It's usually translated as biases, but it literally means leaning. So the mind leans in a particular way. And of course, that perception of leaning with a certain bias sets everything in motion. And what the Buddha is saying in the bias is chandakati, dosakati, mohakati, bayakati, sort of bias through desire, bias through aversion, bias through delusion, bias through fear, so that the mind leans in a particular way. And then the whole chain of feelings, perceptions, thoughts, proliferations start cascading from that. So being able to understand, well, this is just a perception that I've got, one of fear or of aversion or of desire. Is that substantial? Is it even necessary? Is it useful? Is it beneficial? And so then being able to undermine the underlying perception that we have assumed its substantiality to it. Yeah, or things that lead us in the courses of wrong action. Akusala kammapada, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. The four courses of wrong speech, there's four courses of views and mental formations that are built up through desire, through aversion, through harmful thoughts. And its opposite, supporting and encouraging the perceptions that lead to an appreciation of sila or of the wholesome foundations of wholesome action, loving kindness, compassion. And those are things that lead to stability, ditibhagya-sanya, that one is recognizing the inherent benefit of qualities of mind that are stable and solid and unshakable and bright states of mind. The precepts, bharami, is a cultivation of bharami, opting for patience rather than impatience, opting for putting forth effort rather than inaction. These are ways of training the mind. Those choices are seeded by the perception. And one sees that this is leading to stability. This is leading to well-being. We say bhagya-sanya. Those tend to be described as the meditative skills. But anything that is steady mindfulness, brightness of mind, happiness, vitaka vichara, piti sukha, directing attention to what brings the mind to happiness and joy, or say in the Anapanasati Sutta, gladdening the mind, I breathe in, gladdening the mind, I breathe out. Just that repetition or directing of attention, it brings the mind to a place of brightness and stillness. These are perceptions that when one seeds the mind with that perception, oh, this is a worthy way of directing attention, then the mind inclines to distinction. And the nibbheda bhagya-sanya is, nibbheda is a piercing understanding, penetrating insight. One of the descriptions of the fruits of the practice as one continues to establish clarity is the yatha bhuta jnana dasana, knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. This is the way things are. There are these Four Noble Truths. There is anicca, dukkha, anatta. There is dependent origination. This is actually the way things work. And so then it lays a foundation for penetration, and then the natural result of that penetration is relinquishment. So that we would relinquish what is unskillful because it's in our best interest. So we just see it clearly. Or as we cultivate mindfulness and a steadiness of heart and observe that this particular mode of perception leads the mind to steady states of well-being, we would naturally want to protect and nurture that perception as it increases our happiness. These are just seeing clearly enough to recognize that, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. This is what feels good. This is what is truly a benefit. If we could be more attentive to perceptions that penetrate the nature of our bodies and minds and of the world around us, our relationship to everything would be radically different. Our fascination with the world would easily be replaced with a sense of world weariness, disenchantment, or as, I don't know if Bhikkhu Bodhi is still translating it, as disgust, nibbida. Nibbida is the Pali word. Disenchantment's a good word. Disgust is actually not a bad word because it's literally, it has the that losing the flavor in the sense of gustatory. Yeah.
In this context, what does it mean, disenchantment?
It means like you're just not infatuated with it anymore, not excited about it. It doesn't have that same pull. It's just like, okay, I can put it down, I can let it go. I can relinquish this. I don't need to have this. I don't need to do this. I don't need to be this. There's a disenchantment. But it's also from this sense of nibbida with disenchantment, you just got the natural result is a quality of peace and clarity. In practice, this nibbida, disenchantment, disgust, is an inner quality that loosens the hold of our habitual patterns of perception and conception, just the way we proliferate and think and perceive. It's not the emotional upheaving of finding something abhorrent, repugnant, or offensive. Instead, it's closer to the roots of the word itself, losing one's taste for or not delighting in its flavor, leaving the heart cool, settled, and clear. This sense of disenchantment can be fostered by focusing on the drawbacks of our normal involvement in the world of sensual passions, but it can also be fostered by focusing on the positive aspects of the peace offered by Nibbana. So sometimes it's not just looking at the things that are problematic or difficult or disturbing to one because of desire or craving, but it's also that disenchantment can come through really reflecting on, say, the beautiful aspect of Nibbana. Anyway, any questions with that?
A question back on the word agati. Trying to figure out or understand where it fits in terms of like the flow of the mind. Is it more like an anusaya, an underlying tendency or a potential? Or is it when it's actually started to move into action as to where you put your attention?
I think it's when it's moving more into action, because it means leaning, literally means leaning. So it's making you lean into a certain pattern, lean into a certain reaction, reactivity.
And that initial phase of the uprising of that like shift of attention,
yeah,
that kind of thing into whatever.
Yeah, and it's, again, that's why perception is so important, because perception is the natural, each mental state is associated with a perception. But then where it leans is conditioned by that perception and one's acquiescing to that leaning into it and accepting it. Yeah.
Going back to me, this passion, this enchantment, this passion, the release, until then, like, as I believe once you're on this path, you're starting to see the way things are. And through this path, there's the more we see the way things are, and until then, until the dispassion, are there any practical pointers how to not go to the extreme of aversion or even to the craving of unbecoming?
Suffering. Suffering is always the indicator. As soon as you start seeing the mind, those Four Noble Truths are so important to see, because sometimes we can feel that we're right, but we're miserable. And that's not the point of the practice. It's not the point of the Dhamma. You know, you're just trying too hard to do the right thing, making ourselves miserable, not peaceful. Learning how to read the mind. That make sense?
W- more practical than that.
Well, you don't suffer. You don't.
You don't want to suffer.
Yeah.
Maybe you might know. You might be so used to the suffering that you actually don't know it's actually suffering.
Well, that's where most people exist.
If you don't know.
Yeah, but I mean that's why we are here.
Right.
And that sense of everybody that's sitting here is here because they're already sort of have a motivation and a dissatisfaction with that sense of dis-ease, discontent, dissatisfaction. It's not that we're not necessarily miserable suffering, but it's that sense of dukkha, you know, not quite in balance, not quite steady.
This is like asking ourselves that question. Am I content? Am I peaceful? Am I perfectly happy?
Yeah, I can remember Ajahn Chah prodding me one time and said, you know, because he says, is it suffering? I said, well, no. Well, felt good at the time. But then I reflect, you know, down the line later, wow, that was really suffering. So it's just, that was...
How are you going to describe, like, between happiness, you know, the world itself? I think there's the difference between these two words.
Well, I mean, English is always a problem. Or any language, actually, is always a problem. Because even in Thai, it's not as if it's clear. It just has so many connotations. Sukha, dukkha. I mean, it's just, you've got a huge range of its expression. But Gajahn Chah sort of say, the language of Dhamma is the language of feeling. And as long as you're trying to define something with words, trying to define something and get it exactly defined in a language that you understand, you're going to be dissatisfied. You're never going to, how do I feel? Do I feel at ease? Do I feel peaceful? Do I feel clear? Do I feel content? Is this stability? Yeah.
Can you give an example? You're talking about perceptions. So for example, in a practical context, you're practicing in a practical context. So for example, a perception that is an underlying fear or aversion or something arises. Maybe just take fear. And the familiar way of, you know, there's a very familiar path that the mind would go, but then we catch it. We know, okay, this is a perception of fear. From that point on, how would you practice?
Well, then you can challenge it with a different perception. Okay, something might be perceived as a threat, something that one feels threatened by. And say, well, do I need to respond like that? Can I bring a perception of kindness to this? Can I bring a perception of acceptance to this? Can I bring a perception of patience with this. When one challenges it with some kind of counterpoint, maybe, that helps one to shift the perception so that the thought processes start to follow in that direction.
How do we reconcile this with the practice of opening and allowing and embracing?
Have you heard me talk about opening and allowing? If I say it, then you can challenge, you can question me on it. These are skillful means that you can use, because sometimes you've got to really have to investigate the nature of experience to understand it. And sometimes you just have to step back. And each one has its benefit, and each one has its drawback. It's not as if that somehow, somewhere, there's a perfect practice that I do. If I just did that perfect practice, then I would realize Dhamma. And it's just not that way at all.
You're talking about a sense of agility, being able
to
find the right things.
Yeah. So there will be sometimes when being, you know, just open and receptive is an appropriate tool. And then there's times when it's not. It depends on how the mind responds.
Could you even say that open receptivity is another skillful perception?
Well, yeah, I guess it's another way of looking at it. It's another skillful perception. What you do is you start collecting kind of tools in your tool belt and figuring out what works. So I was talking about disenchantment and paying attention to the drawbacks of our involvement in sensual passion. But another angle on that is disenchantment can be fostered by focusing on the positive aspects of the peace offered by Nibbana. This is sort of one of my favorite quotes of the Buddha. It comes up in many different settings. This is one. Hirananda, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, a monk reflects thus, this is peaceful, this is sublime. That is, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, cessation, Nibbana. This contemplation of Nibbana is something that has so many wholesome or positive connotations that the mind is drawn to it and relinquishes other aspects of, say, lower fascination or obsession. This perception is termed the perception of cessation. That's in the...
Girimananda?
Thank you. It was turned to the image. It started with a G, Girimananda. Girimananda Sutta, Anguttara 10, the recollection of the peace of Nibbana, Upasama Anusati. There's 10 Anusatis, 10 recollections, and recollection of the peace of Nibbana, which the Buddha praised in glowing terms. And this is in Anguttara 1:20-102. Monks, if even for the lasting of a finger snap, a monk should practice the recollection of the peace of Nibbana, such a one may be called a monk. He is one whose meditation is not fruitless, abides doing the master's bidding, takes advice, and eats the country's alms food to some purpose. What could I not say of those who make much of recollection of the peace of Nibbana? So that image comes up. And for me, I oftentimes bring it up. This is peaceful, this is sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, cessation, Nibbana. In Pali, etang panidang yadidang sabbasankhara samata sabbupadipati nisago tanhakayo nirodho Nibbana. In some places it has viraka as well, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. Yeah.
Is that also Anguttara Nikaya 10:120?
This one is in 10:60, but that phrase, etang satin, etang panidan, that comes up in quite a few places through the canon, where the Buddha is describing the goal, really, or praising the goal. Yeah, this is peaceful, this is sublime, this is worthy of one's attention. Santi is, of course, peace. Panidang is refined or sublime. That is sabbasankhara samatha. Samatha, of course, is the stilling of all formations. Samatha is a tranquility, bringing all the various formations, particularly mental formations, to a place of stillness. Sabbupadhyam parted up yesterday, that word upadhi, acquisitions, it's both the material world of acquisitions, but also the mental world of the acquisition of personality and temperament, acquiring the five khandhas and the five aggregates as the basis of identification. And the tanhakayo, the destruction of craving, and the kaya, because sometimes destruction is, somehow I've got to annihilate this craving, which is not really a helpful tool. But kaya literally means wearing away or diminution, exhaustion, ending. It has a different flavor to it. In that sense of destroying, is that, you know, being willing to wear it away, you know, let it come to a place of settling.
The term disenchantment, I stumbled upon the term dark night of the soul. Is this a similar term?
Yes, although I'm familiar with the term, but I'm not familiar with the literature. Whether it's like a dark night of the soul is accompanied by a sense, because disenchantment is also, you know, just using the word nipida in Pali, it's not associated with distress. It's associated with very bright states of mind, very bright states of heart. Whereas my understanding, which I have no basis for where that perception comes from, the dark night of the soul is a certain feeling of turmoil or almost like an abandonment that is part of a spiritual quest. Certainly in Buddhism, there are plenty of opportunities to suffer in different ways, but the experience of nipita, from what's translated as disenchantment, is not associated with unhappiness or distress. It's a completely bright and wholesome state of being. Sometimes it's really helpful to get to know some of the Pali language or the terminology that is used, because it has very different connotations than the words that we use in English, or even though the English is not, it's not as if it's incorrect, but it doesn't give a full flavor. And nipita is a really good example of that, because in English you say, yeah, disenchantment or disgust even. Those are, you know, quite negative terms. But the flavor of nipita is the mind is finally starting to disentangle itself from the stress involved with the world of the senses and the world around one and the world of being. And there's a willingness to set that aside, so there's an experience of peace and brightness. It's a very good question, because it's the English language is sometimes not so helpful. And it is important to get a sense of what is the original, what's the Buddha pointing to? Because even the word dukkha, I mean, that's, you translate it as suffering into, well, that doesn't really get it at all.
Seems like just sometimes the Western mentality, and particularly how Western psychology has evolved, is often around these really kind of dark, difficult, obstructive states of mind that, you know, and the language comes from that.
The language comes from that, yeah. And somehow, if it's not dramatic, it's not so interesting. Which is, yeah, it's just, you could just be really ordinary to be peaceful and happy. Why not? I think I'll wrap it up there.